Listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio, produced by Pete Zimmerman. This is John Williams, and we'll be here till 1 o'clock with news about the economics of the world, big and small, for you and for all of us. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio, and today we start with the return visit from Jared Dillian, the best-selling financial author, JaredDillianMoney.com. I'll spell that for you in a moment. First, let's welcome Jared back. Hi, Jared. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Happy New Year. Is it going to be a happy New Year? Do you like the landscape generally going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be, you know, for investors, I think it's going to be a more challenging year than last year. It really doesn't get any easier than last year, so I do think it's going to be a little more choppy and a little more challenging.
Why do you say it doesn't get any easier than last year? What was easy about last year?
Well, you know, I mean, if you manage to make it through the crash back in March, asset prices pretty much just went up in a straight line for the rest of the year. And if you bought something, it probably went up. So, you know, in terms of my career, I think the last time we had a year like this was back in 2013. And this one was much more epic than that.
I thought you might say that, and yet I'll bet nobody would want to do that again.
Well,
at least not that way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 2020 was tough for a lot of reasons because of isolation and disconnectedness and stuff like that. But from an investment standpoint, I mean, it was really one of the best years ever.
But when we were in April, did you know that this was going to happen? Did you say, oh, good, 2021 is going to be great?
I didn't say that 2021 was going to be great.
2020, obviously, the year going forward, yeah.
But I did feel that that there was too much doom and gloom priced in at the time. I mean, if you think about how, if you go back to March of last year, I mean, we were thinking we were going to have millions of deaths, that we were going to have multiple years of lockdowns. I mean, that was really how bad sentiment got. And you know, it still ended up being bad, but nowhere near as bad as people thought it would be.
I remember in March and April thinking, well, I can't retire, or I can't retire the way I thought I was going to, and it's going to be pushed way, way back, because if you're lucky enough to have a 401k or some sort of, you know, retirement portfolio, and I don't have a rich one, I thought, okay, I'll retire someday, but my life going forward will forever be different because I'll never be able to recover these losses. 6 months later, I was on the plus side. It was it was remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, that the recovery, you know, we've had a series of crashes over the last 100 years. I mean, we've had, you know, 9 or 10 crashes of this magnitude, but this is the first time we've ever had a recovery that was that impulsive, where we regained the highs within the span of a couple of months. So that was actually the part that was unusual.
Maybe the crash was impulsive too, right? I mean, that was the impulsive part of it, wasn't it? Perhaps the stocks really do reflect their value, and what happened was just a giant legitimate scare.
Yeah, it was a big scare. And what, you know, what happened after that is that, you know, policymakers went into overdrive, and you really had, you know, intervention from the Fed on an unprecedented scale, especially when you're talking about the Fed buying corporate bonds. And, you know, because back during the crash, I mean, the corporate bond market was completely dislocated. It wasn't functioning. You had bonds getting out to 12 or 14% yields. We would have had massive defaults, and, you know, the Fed stepped in and started buying credit and brought interest rates down, and that played a big role in the recovery.
Do you think then that gets lost, the government intervention, and how maybe it's the Fed, maybe it's federal policies, but do you think we don't appreciate enough the fact that we are where we are today because of those?
You know, when I think about this, you know, I go back to 2008. And a lot of people don't have an appreciation for how close we came to financial Armageddon back in 2008. You know, when Lehman went bankrupt, when they declared bankruptcy, Lehman had about $700 million worth of commercial paper outstanding. And there was a money market mutual fund called the Reserve Primary Fund that owned a fair amount of that lien in commercial paper. And that caused that fund to break the buck, to go from an NAV of 1 to 0.97. And that sparked off a run on money market funds. And you had trillions of dollars leaving money market funds within the span of a couple of days. And the whole system was on the verge of collapse. And the Fed came in and stepped in and backstopped all the money market funds. And that, you know, people really don't realize how close we came to the edge.
So, hooray for the U.S. government policy in that case.
Well, that's really should be the role of the central bank, is to be the lender of last resort. I mean, that is one role of not just the central bank, but the government. You know, I mean, if we can talk about the morality of the stimulus checks, but, you know, absent that government support, you know, you could have millions of people living in tents. So we have to decide what we want.
Well, that was what I was about to ask you then. If the equivalent of that is maybe the sort of stimulus checks or unemployment supplements we've enjoyed to some degree at the end of 2020, did you support those policies, and do you support stimulus checks going forward?
I supported them back in the beginning, about 6 months ago. I don't support them now because I think we've come to a point where they're a little bit superfluous, and we run the risk of being addicted to this stimulus, and people become accustomed to receiving a check periodically every 6 months or so. You know, if we give out $2,000 to every person in the country, that costs $600 billion. And we can't do that on a sustained basis. It's not sustainable because of the debt. And you and I have talked about the debt before.
I have to just mention, though, that the people are addicted to stimulus checks. They got one. They got one. And the next one is for half. If they were addicted, they'd be dead by now.
The government has not been saving people. There's also been the PPP loans. There's been the enhanced unemployment benefits. We've handed out a lot of cash. Huh. We've handed out a lot of cash.
Let's debate those details in a moment. And actually, I want to ask you about this. Your five surprises for 2021. Jared Dillian is on a phone line, the best-selling financial author. His website is jareddillianmoney.com, and we'll pick it up here in a minute. It is at 12:18 on WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Jared Dillian, jareddillianmoney.com, best-selling financial author, is a guest of ours. I don't want to dwell on this point, but let's just go back to the last thing you said about people getting addicted to stimulus checks, and I pushed back a little bit. Let's just finish that point before we move on to your thoughts about 2021, Jared. Did I misunderstand what you were saying?
No, I don't think you misunderstood me, but I wasn't really referring to people, American citizens, getting addicted to stimulus checks. I was really referring to the government getting addicted to stimulus checks because, you know, I mean, if you announce that you're going to give out $600 or $1,400 or whatever, there's a lot of positive effects. It makes the stock market go up. It makes the economy faster. It makes the economy stronger. And, you know, there's sort of a feedback loop. And I think if you're a policymaker, if you're a legislator and you see this happening, then you say, well, if I can make money by pushing a button, how many times am I going to push the button?
I understand that, but I think what is galling to people, the government shut the businesses down. The government shut the economy down for the sake of our well-being, mind you. But people didn't just quit. They're not lazy. They want to work, and they need to pay bills, and they need to eat. And when the government says you can't have money, and then they don't give you any money in return to survive, that's not me being addicted to stimulus. And frankly, the government owes us a little stimulus. They should be paying a little supplement on the unemployment side. That's what I'm hearing back from our listeners.
Well, you know, that's a good point. I agree with that. The other thing that I'll say is, you know, when we just passed the $900 billion stimulus a couple of weeks ago and we handed out $600 checks, that only made up $180 billion out of the $900 billion stimulus, and the rest of it was going towards nonsense. So we should probably rethink our priorities in terms of, you know, the cash that we're giving out to people.
When I get to be king, I will have a streamlined version of that. And I know we conflated a federal bill that was going to happen anyway with the stimulus bill, and there was some confusion, sometimes deliberate confusion, about which was which. But at the end of the day, yeah, we should find a more streamlined way to give people money and not tack other things on. We would know the true cost of that if we did. Let's move on to your five surprises for 2021. And the first surprise is no surprise, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the biggest surprise that we could have of this year is that there's not going to be any surprises, that this will be a boring year, that stocks will be up a boring amount and bonds will be up or down a boring amount, and there won't be any crashes and there won't be any melt-ups, and maybe volatility will be low and stable, and maybe there will be nothing out of the Fed. Maybe there will just, we'll just have a boring year. I think that would surprise everybody. Everybody is expecting another crash, something crazy happening like it did last year. Maybe that doesn't happen this year.
I wonder what would precipitate that. I mean, we're through the virus, so I wonder what would precipitate something like that.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of boring years. I mean, if I think about over the last 10 years, 2011 was pretty exciting. 2012 was pretty exciting. 13 was a good year. 14, you know, 14, 15 were pretty boring. I mean, we've had some boring years in there. So it's you know, it's very likely that this just ends up being a quiet year.
That's not a bad thing necessarily, is it?
No. I mean, there's an old saying on Wall Street that you never want to short a dull market. So it could be good for stocks.
Let's talk about surprise number two. We will have higher than expected inflation. Why do you say that and characterize that? Is that good or bad?
Well, if you go back to 2008, everybody thought we were going to have inflation in 2008 because the Fed was doing quantitative easing. They were printing money to buy government bonds. And a lot of people thought that this cash would find its way into the economy and make prices go up. That never happened. Inflation is basically where it was 12 years ago. It's still about 2%. The difference is that this time we're doing it on the fiscal side. And we're talking about the stimulus checks and the PPP loans and everything else. And this is going to people who have lower than average incomes, who have a higher marginal propensity to spend. And, you know, there is a pretty strong likelihood that this money could find its way into the economy and speed it up and make prices higher.
I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
It depends how much inflation we get. Now, one thing that I always like to say is that the early part of inflation, when you're talking about 2, 3, 4% inflation, it feels good. It's very enjoyable. Once you start getting above 4 or 5% inflation, then it gets to be very disruptive. Now, I don't think we're going to have above 4% inflation this year. In fact, even 4% inflation would probably be a stretch. But I certainly don't think we're going to have deflation from here.
Surprise number three on your list is the great moderation. What's that?
The great moderation is the idea that we reached the peak of political polarization last year. I mean, if you saw what happened in the summer, we literally had left-right street battles in the street, people getting killed, you know, just all kinds of hate and discontent going on. I think that's going to disappear going forward. In fact, if you saw what happened at the Capitol the other day after the riots in the Capitol, after that had been put down, you saw lawmakers making conciliatory remarks, starting to work together. And I do think that there's going to be a spirit of cooperation and collaboration in Washington this year.
And the market actually had a good day afterwards. I don't know that it was because of that, but it was also not a bad day at the market. The market did not look at what happened at the Capitol and say, okay, we're a dysfunctional place and we have to maybe sell everything. That did not happen. That was the best news to me.
By the way, I just got a piece of news come across my screen. Senator Joe Manchin says absolutely not to a round of $2,000 stimulus checks. And it looks like the market is kind of rolling over here and going down on those remarks.
What does your screen show you right now on that?
The S&P is down at 37.94, down about 0.5% from where it was about 10 minutes ago.
And I think a lot of us, and maybe the markets, were counting on that. Manchin is out. He's not the sole decider, but it's a very even Senate, so you'll need 50 plus one for something to go forward.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, thanks for the heads up on that. Oil prices, 2021?
Yeah, I think oil prices are going to continue to go up. You know, they're above 50 now for the first time in a long time. And what's going to happen is that once the vaccines are distributed and people begin to travel, they're going to be driving more than they were before. They're going to be flying more than they were before. There's going to be a huge demand for gas on the demand side. And the supply side is very constrained. There's been a lot of offshore rigs that have been taken offline. There's been a lot of a lot of wells in the Permian that have been taken offline. And, I mean, just from a supply-demand standpoint, I think that oil is at least going to go to 60, probably in the next couple of months.
And that would mean, obviously, higher prices at the pump at some point, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're paying, I don't know what gas prices are in Chicago, but let's say the national average is about $2.50 a gallon. It could be $3 by the end of the year, for sure.
And while nobody wants to pay more than they have to for gas, that's usually a sign, though, that the economy is humming along when the prices of fuel are going up, right?
Yes, it's a positive. It is a positive sign, and you know, the energy industry employs a lot of people. It's a very big industry. And, you know, the economy depends on having a healthy energy industry.
One other thing, then. Let's talk about the Fed and what they, you think, are going to do in 2021.
Well, it's interesting. You know, what I said was that the Fed starts moving in a hawkish direction prematurely, and that's actually happening already. Fed President Rafael Bostic of Atlanta, of the Atlanta Fed, is already talking about tapering asset purchases. Basically cutting back on the levels of quantitative easing that the Fed is doing. There was another Fed president that echoed those remarks. I can't remember who it is. But that is definitely a risk that the Fed starts moving in a hawkish direction, and that would definitely take the wind out of the stock market.
Jared Dillian from JaredDillianMoney.com. Any last thoughts or comments for us today, Jared?
Yeah, just since, you know, if you've been investing in 2020, this is going to be a more difficult year. It's going to be more challenging and probably not as rewarding. There's been a lot of people who got rich this year investing, and it's going to be difficult to do that in the future.
If you were dollar cost averaging, you probably came out ahead then, because for a few months you were buying stocks or mutual funds, most likely at a discounted price, right?
Yeah, that's true. But dollar cost averaging takes a lot of courage in bad times. And, you know, when we crashed back in March, a lot of people didn't continued to dollar cost average. They actually stopped because they were scared. And that's the thing with dollar cost averaging. You have to do it in good times and you have to do it in bad times.
Yeah.
And if you only do it in good times, you're basically just buying high and not buying low.
Well, isn't the great temptation right now to sell, to take the profits off the table?
Yeah, and if you're a long-term investor, if you're investing for your retirement, I wouldn't get in the game of trying to time the market, thinking that you're going to sell and buy it back lower, because, look, stocks go up over time, and if you have a 20-year time horizon, just hold on, and 20 years from now, I can pretty much assure you that the stock market is going to be higher.
I have 30 seconds left, but say your horizon is 3 or 4 years from now. I wouldn't blame you for either taking your profit or insulating yourself from losses. Hey, we recovered. We even made a little ground. Be satisfied with that. What do you make of that strategy?
No, that's absolutely true. And if you only have a couple years to retirement, you have to look at your asset allocation. If you're 60, 70% stocks and you're 62, 63 years old, then you have too many stocks and you should cut your risk and move into fixed income.
JaredDillianMoney.com. Jared, we'll visit again. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit now about how businesses do in Illinois and what we're doing to attract them. I just saw an interesting statistic that Illinois' economy is the 18th largest economy in the world. Did I read that correctly? Alia Woods is the acting CEO and COO of Intersect Illinois. InterSectIllinois.org is their website. Alia, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm doing well. Great to be with you.
Yeah, likewise. I didn't know that. Did I get that right? 18th largest economy in the world is Illinois'?
I believe that's true. We go up and down in that ranking, but we usually end up somewhere right around the size of the Netherlands, if you can believe that.
Huh. You know, it's funny because so much of the reporting about the state the last few months, the end of the year with the census coming out, was how people are exiting Illinois. I want to hear anything we can do to attract people and businesses here. I guess that's your initiative too, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, Intersect is about a four-year-old non-for-profit organization. We are a public-private partnership, and we support statewide economic development for all of Illinois with a primary focus on business attraction. And, you know, we are keenly aware of the challenges that Illinois faces, and population is one of them. And that's going to be, you know, kind of an effort that, that has a lot of different strategies to approach it, but certainly getting businesses into the state and getting them to grow here in the state is one of the most important ways we think of growing, you know, growing the population here and growing economic opportunity.
What's the biggest obstacle to getting businesses to locate here?
Well, you know, this year has been extraordinary, obviously. But it, in fact, our pipeline of new possible projects is pretty much as strong as ever. I would say, you know, there's a challenge with COVID in getting kind of final location decisions made, since a lot of the time executives are still not really able to travel to make those final kind of site selection choices and plans to expand. But I think you'll see that as soon as we get kind of the clear to travel, that a lot of those things are going to start moving pretty quickly again, as we have a lot of potential projects in our pipeline.
I hope that that moves expeditiously, but somebody who's planning on moving to Dallas might just as expeditiously move there. If you ask me what I thought some of the challenges are you would run into were you to try and attract a business here, I would say our taxes, our politics, and maybe the fear that Chicago is too violent a place. I live and work downtown Chicago every single day. Well, I work downtown. I live in a neighborhood in the city. But my point is, I'm intimately aware of and love the city. And I think if people knew what a great place it is, they would overcome some of those obstacles and they would come here. But that's me talking to me.
Sure.
Do you run into those kinds of obstacles when you do try to sell Chicago or Illinois to other people?
We certainly get those types of questions when we are, you know, pitching the city or the state to prospective, clients, as we call them, but companies who are thinking about location decisions. And I think we have a long list of things that we have to offer. Certainly with regard to our talent base, our workforce here is incredibly strong. And, you know, most of the time, that's the kind of number one deciding factor for companies coming in. Certainly if all they're thinking about is kind of where can they build the cheapest building, there are a lot of options for doing that. But there are a lot of differentiators here that make Illinois, you know, really a top choice. And Chicago certainly is competitive cost-wise when you look at other metros. And as you said, when you bring people into the loop or into any of our, you know, many diverse and exciting neighborhoods or suburbs, people can really see that there's so much more to offer here, along with, you know, all of the assets that everybody knows about, you know, kind of our infrastructure and, you know, location geographically being kind of in the center of the country and such a transportation and logistics hub. You know, many companies will make the decision to come here sort of based on those factors. You know, companies are always going to have questions about taxes, about their bottom line, and about safety. But I feel like we're able to really address those concerns when you look at the data and the numbers kind of behind those perceptions. And I think one of the things that we really want to focus on in 2021 is solidifying kind of our brand and our pitch and making sure that we're telling the positive stories and we're getting all of that kind of the good news out there.
What is our brand? What's part and parcel of the pitch?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, Illinois has struggled for a long time by being, you know, really good at a lot of things. Like, we have a lot of incredibly strong industries here, whether it's agriculture, transportation, manufacturing, you know, tech being really up and coming here. It's been hard to say, you know, we're really good at just one thing because we have so many things that we're really good at. But I think that the work ethic of people here in the Midwest, our ability to make things and to move things, is our differentiator. And that's not just in Chicago. That's really statewide.
Yeah. Well, so do you point maybe to a Caterpillar in central Illinois? I mean, who's heard of Morton? But they sell products all around the world that are manufactured in Morton, Illinois. To me, that would be a compelling argument for somebody who's thinking about manufacturing in this state.
You know, absolutely, and it's not just Caterpillar. We have such a legacy of these world-class companies that have been industry-defining, whether it's Cat or ADM or, you know, State Farm down in Bloomington. It's not just the Chicago story, but then there's also, you know, so many others, Kraft, Mondelez, et cetera, kind of up in the suburbs that have had these huge global brands that have been really, you know, game-changing and significant.
I got to go, but if people want help either expanding their business, retaining a business, attracting a business, I mean, What resources do you have, or how do they reach out to you?
Yeah, we are. So intersectillinois.org, as you mentioned, we really help manage that site selection process for dozens of companies and consultants. Every day, every week, we get new clients and calls coming in. We have a really great research team. We can do workforce analysis, supply chain analysis, and we work really closely with private sector, you know, partners like Wintrust, who, you know, brought us together today to really make sure we have a whole kind of suite of services available to offer to companies that are considering doing business here in Illinois.
Good to know we got folks like this doing this. Alia Woods is the acting CEO and COO of Intersect Illinois. Intersectillinois.com. Thanks, Alia. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
It's 12:41. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch and more business news now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based Boeing is paying a hefty fine over its handling of the 737 MAX. The Department of Justice says the company will pay $2.5 billion following the two crashes that left hundreds dead just months apart in 2018 and 2019. The DOJ says the devastating events unveiled fraudulent and deceptive conduct by those working for Boeing. The 737 MAX planes were grounded for more than a year because of the crashes. The CEO of Conagra Brands thinks pandemic-driven consumer behavior and sales momentum will continue even after the coronavirus has been beaten back. Chief Executive Sean Connolly says he expects the new enthusiasm for cooking and packaged foods to continue well into the future. As a result, the food giant is now adding production capacity and marketing specifically for popcorn and some frozen meals. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Maybe you're working from home these days, and you don't have the desk and the chair and everything to support your posture the way you used to, and that's more than a small inconvenience for you working at home now. That can actually be debilitating. Now your hands, your wrists, your shoulders, things just aren't aligned properly, your back too. Or maybe you've been exercising more. Were you that guy? And you tore a rotator cuff. I mean, I've heard of examples of both of these things of late. I've got a little of that going on myself. We're reaching out now to Matt Gauthier, who is a doctor of physical therapy at Athletico. Visit athletico.com. Hi, Matt. Welcome to WGN. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Are those two scenarios things you all are encountering?
Yeah, we're certainly seeing both. People who have had a significant decrease in their activity and people who have kind of gone the other way and really kind of increased their physical activity, working out more at home.
Well, let's just talk about each group then. What walks in the door? Let's start with the people that are not doing as much as they used to. How does that lead them to some sort of strain or some sort of injury that would require them to go to Athletico?
You know, the biggest thing we're seeing with people who are having, you know, a decreased activity level is they're kind of stuck in the same position all day. And what I always tell my patients is it's not so much the posture or the sitting itself that's bad. It's just the lack of movement. So normally at work, you might have a chance to, you know, walk around, go talk to different people, go do different tasks around your place of work. Now you're kind of holed up on your couch or at your home office, and you're just not moving as much, and that lack of movement seems to be what is really getting people some aches and pains.
Are you an advocate for telling people to stand while they're working or stand while they're watching TV? Does that make a difference?
I don't think that's a catch-all. I think just having a variance in movement is probably the most important thing. So probably the most common advice I get is every 2 hours or so, just get up, walk around, stretch a little bit. Just make sure that you're not in the same position, whether it's sitting or standing, for a long period of time.
Well, if somebody came in, though, and as a result of, I mean, so what happens? They walk into an Athletico. What do you do about that?
So the first thing we kind of figure out is, you know, what specific activities really seem to bother you? Is it sitting for a long time? Is it standing? Then we can do an assessment, see, you know, what is stiff, what's tight, what's weak. And based on, you know, what they're telling us and what we're seeing, we can address these deficits with some exercises, mobility work, things like that. So it's just finding kind of what they are feeling, what they're telling us they're feeling, and then what we see physically, and just coming up with a program to get them moving again.
I don't want to dwell on me here, but I'm going to tell you what I went through, and maybe this something that other people can relate to. And this is a free visit for me. So I was doing a sit-up, and as I was, I would put my left elbow on my right knee, then my right elbow on my left knee, and I thought everything was fine the next day. I had a really sore left clavicle, just a, not in the spine, but in the clavicle, and then a tingling sensation going all the way down my left arm. And that's still kind of there, like my left arm is asleep a lot. I don't know if that's some neurological thing I got to get addressed, or it's just a little nerve strain I've exacerbated as a result of not doing a sit-up properly. What do you think about all of that?
Yeah, so if you were my patient in the clinic, the first thing I would ask is this something that you normally do, or is this something that you saw online or decided that you were going to start doing that day? Because a lot of times it's these new activities that are the issue. If you're not used to this kind of motion, sometimes the body's a little more sensitive to performing something like that. So that'd be my first approach there. Second, just kind of seeing if you were any more or less tired than usual, if anything else had changed in your life around that time that could make that tissue a little more tender, a little more sore. And if there's nothing there, then we kind of go into a physical exam and see, you know, how does that shoulder move? How does the elbow move? How does the neck move? What's weak? What's tight? And kind of go from there.
Is it ultimately, though, going to require rest? I mean, I think a lot of people think, yeah, I could go get it fixed, or I could just rest. Either way, you know, it'll be the same amount of time. The best way to go get your back fixed, they say, is you can go to a doctor, and he'll tell you to rest 2 weeks or just rest 2 weeks. Talk to me a little bit about the fact that what you really just have to do is lay off the area that's bothering you.
So it's a good question because it's a question I get a lot in the clinic. I think for the most part, I think most people will say, you know, if I just take it easy, this will get better. But not too many things get better just by doing nothing. Yeah, there's certainly a value in rest. Some people do need rest. But there's actually some pretty good research out there that says that continuing to move, especially after like a neck or a back strain within your comfortable range, is what's going to help you the most. It's the actual immobility after an injury that kind of makes things snowball and makes things worse. So my initial visit, I'll tell people, I'm fine with you moving within your comfortable range. I don't want people just to you know, lay up in bed for a couple of weeks. That takes more work to kind of, you know, work through the effect of the immobility.
An interesting point. But I think there's a lot of concern, too, people, the way their elbows, hands, arms are positioned at a keyboard. We spend too much time hunched over. And, well, you didn't dwell on that a moment ago. I wish you just would address the ergonomics or posture for people of working at home. What should they be thinking about? What should they do right?
I'd say the most important thing is probably keeping things relatively in front of you, you know, kind of straight ahead. If you're looking for this ideal ergonomic posture, it's having your feet flat on the ground, you know, your knees and hips being at 90 degrees. The keyboard should be kind of at a comfortable, you know, arms width in front of you, so you can have your elbows resting at your sides width in front of you, so you're not reaching forward and you're not having to reach really far for the mouse either. But again, I think the biggest thing, which some of the research is supporting, is it's not even so much just sitting in that position. That position in of itself isn't the problem, but it's being in that position for a long period of time. So you can help yourself by putting yourself in a good ergonomic position, but I still think that the best thing to do is just make sure you're moving from that position on occasion, probably every 2 hours.
Matt Gauthier is a doctor of physical therapy at Athletico, athletico.com. And you guys are still open, right? You are still doing inpatient, correct? That is, people can come into the Athletico's?
Correct, yes. We have been open throughout the pandemic.
And, you know, we did some commercials for you. I don't know that I'm doing them right now, but I remember one of the things we said was you don't need a prescription, right? That you can just walk in and say, hey, I got this thing, and you guys could actually initiate the process right there.
Correct. So in Illinois, for the last couple of years, there has been what's called direct access, which means for a majority of insurances, somebody can just come in off the street. We can evaluate them without a prescription and determine if this is a person or condition that is appropriate for physical therapy or if this is something that would benefit from being referred out.
There's about 1,000. You guys are like Starbucks. They're everywhere. And I really do think I need to walk into one. Do you care about shoes that people wear? Do you talk to them about that much?
It kind of depends on what you're at the clinic for. If I'm seeing you for your shoulder, I don't necessarily need you to be wearing athletic shoes. If you're going to be doing some running, probably be best to wear wear some sort of athletic shoe.
Yeah, no kidding. Any last tips then for us as we hunker down for the winter?
I think the biggest thing is to keep moving, again, to avoid these kind of aches and pains from sitting at your home workstation. Just make sure you're moving. One thing I know I talk to my patients about is take time to take care of yourself. I feel like the line between work and home life is very blurred. People are working longer hours and not taking breaks. So take the time, take care of yourself, get some exercise, and I think that's probably the best thing to help you through this winter.
Well, you know, the idea is that we're working at home, and we realize now that what we're really doing is living at work. So people, I think, are putting in more hours or more hours in less than perfect situations now than they were, say, last year. I'll bet you agree with that.
I would definitely agree with that.
All right. Hey, listen, Matthew Gauthier, a doctor of physical therapy at Athletico. Which one are you at, Matthew? Where will I bump into you?
I am at the Niles Northwest Chicago Clinic. So I am as far northwest as you can get in the city, and I can look out the window and see that Leaning Tower in Niles.
Yeah, right, right. All right. Thanks for your time, doctor. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much.
Athletico.com is their website. Okay, I'm not going to the Niles one, but I think I might find one near me.